You know, some people believe these are the primary connections within the basal ganglia, but a lot of this is, you know, very controversial, what I'm saying. So pretty much there is evidence for almost any one of these structures connected to any other one, I would say, okay? So as I said, though, you know, the theory which I don't want to understand due to DeLong and others, their basic idea is that the information is going to come from the cortex to the striatum primarily. And then remember, the output is the GPI SNR to the thalamus. The SNC is where dopamine is primarily produced, so this has to be very important, and that feeds primarily to the striatum. Now, there are two primary routes from the striatum, the input to the output. There's the so-called direct pathway, so the striatum goes directly to the output nuclei, and then there's the indirect pathway. So this goes to GPE, to the subthalamic nuclei, and then to the output. So there's a couple things to notice here. So most of the connections are inhibitory, it's in red. The only real inhibitory connections within the basal ganglia comes from the subthalamic nucleus. So that's excitatory to both GPE and GPR. As I said, there are evidence for many, many other connections. So for example, there's a very strong excitatory input from the cortex to STM, which people believe to be very, very important. Okay. There's also a connection from GPE to GPI, which a number of papers people feel are important. Okay. Notice that I have from the SNC to striatum both excitatory and inhibitory. That's because dopamine acts different ways on different cells. There's even, you know, different type of dopamine receptors. And it is believed that its action on the indirect pathway is different than its action on the direct pathway. There's the D1 and D2 receptors.
You're not showing the connections within the areas.
Oh, within, let's say within here?
Yeah.
Of course, this is a minefield, of course. This is a tremendous amount of research on the structure of the striatum. There's the matrices, the patches, and all kinds of things. But it's very poorly understood, I would say. So within the GPE, this will actually play an important role in the talk today, is there are inhibitory connections. And there is evidence that dopamine affects these inhibitory connections within GPE. There's excitatory connection with STN, and that will not play a role in my talk, but other people like to talk about this. Okay?
So if you, can you say something about the comparison between local connections and these connections between the ganglia? Only play similar roles, or what do they do?
Right. So one thing in my talk will be the role of the local connections here, and how it can affect the more global patterns that arise. Okay, that's really all I can say.
Is there any time scales or time delays that separate the network at all?
There has been a lot of work on people trying to see if the activity comes right before the movements or right after the movements. And it's been a while since I looked at that, but it's not right before, I guess. So it doesn't seem to be directly initiated. And the basal ganglia is believed to be important in a lot of things. So people, the role of dopamine, there's this stuff now on rewards and predictions of rewards and more cognitive functions. So maybe it has more of a role there in planning than in directly initiating the movement. Yes?
What kind of experiments do they do to try and plumb this? I mean, so like with the visual cortex, you just put a probe in and you sort of flash things on and you can measure time lags and that type of thing. I mean, with this, what type of experimental protocol is there where they have put a probe in one of these nuclei and they're trying to, you know, or is that?
like that, you know, more. Like your cellular recording.
What's the answer to that?
Well, there's different sort of movements, I guess, so you might move your arm or whatever and see which neurons respond to that. And there, yes, I can't give more details about this. So here is the standard theory for Parkinson's disease, originally, I think, proposed by Alden and DeLong. And it really does, I think, form the basis of a lot of the surgical procedures that are now going on. So with Parkinson's disease, I think two things people could agree on is that there's a reduction of dopamine, and there's an increased activity in the output of the nuclei. So dopamine, there's reduction here, which acts on the striatum, and there's an increased activity, you know, down here. So a fundamental question could be, you know, how is it that the loss of dopamine here gives rise to an increase of activity here? So the theory is that maybe there's a balance between the direct and indirect pathways. So remember, the dopamine acts differently on the direct pathway and the indirect pathway because of these different receptors. So this is supposed to show the normal, you know, activity. So the loss of dopamine, the story goes, gives rise to an increase of inhibition to the indirect pathway, and a decrease of inhibition to the direct pathway. So, you know, if you think of inhibition as just lowering the firing rate and excitation as raising the firing rate, you would say that, well, okay, you increase inhibition, it decreases the inhibition to the SDN. So if you disinhibition, two negatives make it positive, I guess. So if you decrease inhibition here, you increase excitation, so you increase the activity of the output. Okay, but then people say that there are some, so this is seems to be good at explaining many of the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. I guess Parkinson's disease, there's different symptoms. There's akinesia and bradykinesia. So this is the inability to initiate movement or slowness of movement. And this seems fairly good at explain that. I guess the idea is that if you increase the activity here, you increase inhibition to the thalamus, so that's slowing down movements. But there's other...
Why do you think thalamus is slowing down movement?
I don't know. That's how the story goes.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if there's the right answer for this.
Well, this excitation is important.
Yeah, they're just acting on the cortex. But there have been some problems with this standard theory. One is it doesn't seem to explain tremor. So that's a very important sign of Parkinson's disease. It's not at all clear how you can get this tremor activity. So this is this 4 to 8 hertz oscillation from this fire, just thinking in terms of firing rates. Another issue is, and this is controversial, so I don't want to say too much about it, is that this theory predicts that, well, if you increase inhibition to GPE, so the activity of GPE should go down. And I guess some people have measured the activity in GPE, and it doesn't seem to go down. Some experiments seems like it might go up or it might stay the same, but it doesn't seem to behave the way it should according to this theory. So it seems like what's important is not just the firing rate that's important, but the so there are other experiments, perhaps I should say. Which motivated our work. The last thing I want to say is that the idea of synchrony. So it seems like when you go from the normal, in the normal state, the activity of the neurons within these structures are not correlated with each other. But there's an increased amount of correlation or an increased amount of synchronization when you go to a Parkinsonian state. So again, this does not seem to be something which one can understand purely in terms of firing rates. One has to understand more the pattern of activity. Okay, then there was one last experiment which I'd like to mention, and this is due to Plenz and Kita. I mean, what we, being very naive when I started off, I thought, well, this seemed to be a very nice system which one can try to model. But of course, it's just so complicated, you know, how can one really try to understand that, trying to model, detailed model of these neurons. But Plenz and Kita, what they did is they isolated the GPSTN in a culture or in a dish, I guess. And what they were able to do is show that just this interaction, so this inhibitory-excitatory interactions, was able to generate synchronous oscillations. So this suggested maybe...
What was the manipulation? What did evoke the synchronous oscillations?
Just the activity between these the neurons here.
I mean, there was an experimental manipulation that they did, or
They cut it out of the system, or they grew somehow in a culture, and they looked at the activity of these neurons and was able to generate
these isolated.
Just isolated, purely isolated. Okay. I mean, I guess, again, it's very controversial. What is the origin of tremor? Some people say that maybe tremor is generated in the thalamus, and there's these big loops, the thalamus cortex, STN, and this activity is able to generate the tremor. Another possibility is that the tremor frequency is generated purely within the basal ganglia. So one idea would be that maybe it's just this activity between the GP and STN all by itself is able to generate the tremor oscillation. So this is something that we would want to test with the model. Okay, so what we did, so this is collaboration with John Rubin, LSU, and Charlie Wilson. So the first thing we wanted to do was construct a model for the GPSTN networks. So this is a Hodgkin-Huxley biophysical sort of model for each one of these neurons and hook them up in the model. And as, you know, based on all what is known experimentally, obviously, within this model, just ask, is it possible that this network generates synchronous tremor-like rhythms? And then once we have the computational model, then of course we could play with it and ask, you know, what other sort of patterns of activity can arise? And hopefully by doing that, we could try to reinterpret the role of the indirect pathway. So as I said, there's some controversy about the role of the indirect pathway if you just base it purely on firing rates. So maybe if we construct the model, it can help us, you know, understand some of these issues.
Which was the indirect pathway again?
So the indirect pathway is here, because it doesn't go directly to the output. Okay, so this is the direct pathway. This is the indirect.
And in the experiments, the frequency of the oscillations is about 2 hertz.
One or two, so it's slower.
It's much slower than the...
Right, so that's a good thing to keep in mind. So why is that?
It's a tremor.
So in their experiment, yeah. Okay.
And it's also slower than the oscillations which has been observed in the repeated monkeys.
Right, so this is an important point which I'd like to return to, so remind me. Now that's one thing we wanted to explain, actually. Okay, so in these experiments, in the isolate, so I made this, you know, little pitch that maybe it's the interaction between these guys which generate the tremor, oscillations, but the tremor's at 4 to 8 hertz. But in the experiments of Plentz and Kita, what they saw was a much slower oscillation.
How much?
Around 1 hertz, I would say, or maybe even slower.
Well, this could be modulated by excitation.
Yeah, there is, you know, strong input here, and there's other possibilities. But we're going to see that oscillation.
But there's also another issue, which is that if the GPI, the synchronous oscillation, the path which is synchronized, is at 12 hertz.
Okay.
Between 10 and 12 hertz, and the oscillations, if you look in the autocorrelations, in GPI, you see mainly, I think, something between 6 and 8 hertz. So, is there a problem with...
Well, we can talk about it. I think that's more technical. I don't think it's that difficult to get stuff like that in these models. I'll show some of that. You know, there are papers, if this goes at twice, then these will respond at the right one. Okay, you know, let's get a few.
So when you say that the direct path is inhibitory and the indirect path is excitatory, it is really correct?
So this is inhibitory, and this is excitatory.
The entire path?
This is inhibition. The only excitation comes from the STM.
No, but the entire path is still excitatory, right? Because you have two inhibitions and one excitation.
If you want to think of it that way, that's
right. So this is why I'm asking.
Why do you want to think about it? So the moral of the story is going to be that maybe that's not the best. They're two, you know, inhibition, just not necessarily one excitation. Sometimes, of course, it does, but, you know, inhibition can play many roles. Inhibition can sometimes decrease the firing rate, but sometimes it could increase the firing rate, right, depending on the details of the number. Okay, sometimes it could help synchrony or sometimes it could hurt synchrony. Okay, so one thing one can get out of a modeling study like this is to dissect the roles of intuition. Okay, so I'll go through some of the details of the model. So it seems like there's now data. When we started, there was almost no data even on the how we should model the individual neurons. I've seen quite a controversial. But since then, there have been experiments, for example, due to Bevan and Wolfson, which told us how we should go about modeling at least the STN neurons. So we tried to model the STN-GP neurons as well as we could based on experiments. And then, of course, there's network parameters of, you know, what is the architecture, what is the strength of synaptic coupling, which is very, very poorly understood. So all we did was we tried to build the best model of the individual neurons that we could based on experiments, and then we played with various types of architectures and synaptic couplings and see how those parameters affected the network behavior. And so if you look at the paper of Bevan and Wolfson, they'll tell you that these are, so this is, you know, based on Hodgkin-Huxley type equations, single compartment models. And so there's the weak, the usual potassium and sodium, a calcium-dependent potassium current after hyperpolarization. There's the good old T current, so I'll talk about this. Then there's a high voltage calcium current. This is, in some sense, going to be kind of a minimal model because each one of these currents is going to play an important role, except for maybe this one, in the generation of these oscillations. The only current which probably is not there that maybe should be would be an H current, which some people suggest, but I'll talk a little bit about that, a SAT current. It doesn't seem to play that much a role in the generation of these rhythms, so we did not include it. So I thought it was not necessary really to, you know, give all the gory details of the equations. It's modeled in a pretty standard way. There are many ways that people model the synaptic coupling. So this is going to be input from the GPE neuron. So I thought I would just show you how we do that. So I sin, so this represents the input from the GPE cells to each STN. So it's just another current like this. So there's the maximal conductance, the reversal potential of GABA, probably GABA A here. and then you sum over all the presynaptic GPE neurons, some variable SJ, and each SJ satisfies its own scalar differential equation. So here H is what we call the head step function. So this is either 0 or 1. Well, you can smooth it out, I guess, if you want, depending if the presynaptic potential is above the threshold or below one. So the basic idea is that if a GP neuron's above a threshold, then this basically goes to 1 at a rate alpha. And if this is below a threshold, then this will decay to 0 at a rate beta. So we can play with the rate that the synapse activates or deactivates with these parameters. Okay. Yeah.
So another way one could have done the coupling would have been to just have a little gamma function,
right,
which would be activated every time there was a spike.
Yeah.
And then you would put in your time delay explicitly into the little gamma function. So when you do it this way, what is like the average time lag for your state variable? You know, your presynaptic voltage is going above the threshold, and then your state variable is going to change in some way. Like, what's...
I guess on the order of milliseconds or tens of milliseconds. And then your system should be slower than beta.
So how do you tune whether it's an excitatory connection or an inhibitory connection?
Right. So that's in the reversal potential, V sin.
Okay.
So for GABA, this is minus 80. And if it's excitatory, you can't talk. It's a question if this term is positive or negative. If you think about it, if the derivative is going to increase or decrease. Okay. So, okay. But that's how you determine if it's excitatory or inhibitory, to play with the reversal potential. Okay, I guess that's the reason that I showed you these equations, because I know a lot of people like to model with these alpha or gamma. But I like to stick with everything in terms of a differential equation and not keep track of the firing time.
Yeah, with these little gamma functions, you can explicitly choose whether, you know, your inhibitory things have different time scale than your excitatory things.
Right. But we can do that here, of course, with the alpha or the beta. So for example, you could make alpha a lot bigger than beta, so this is more on a slow time scale, for example. So this is GABA B inhibition, that's something you would do. Okay, so one could play with that sort of thing with the alpha and beta. We could also put delays in there. Again, just my training, I don't particularly like delay equations. So you could put an auxiliary function X. So you say that when the membrane potential rises above the threshold, that activates a variable X. And then when that gets above the threshold, then it affects the differences. So you can put a delay, just everything in terms of differential equations. So that's the sort of thing you do. So these are the basic properties of the neurons, which again are in the paper of Bevan and Wilson that we tried to match with choosing parameters correctly. I think it's better just to show you some pictures. So firing properties of model STM cells, well, they're spontaneously active with no input. Here they're at about 2 or 3 hertz. Okay. So in a monkey, whatever, it'll be a lot faster, but maybe that's because he gets excitatory inputs or whatever. But in vitro, this is what they see. Then what happens is if you raise the input current, these things just love to fire away. And they can fire away really fast, maintaining pretty much the same shape. So if you have I equals 50, I forget the units, then they'll just... Well, here's a plot of the frequency versus the applied current. So they could go up to, you know, hundreds of maintaining pretty much the same shape. Another important property of these cells is the after hyperpolarization. So if you apply a current to it, it'll fire away really fast, and then if you stop the applied current, there'll be a delay before the next action potential after hyperpolarization. So what this is a plot is how long the delay is, the AHP, when you apply a certain current. So if you, the more current you apply, the faster the thing is going to go, and then when you let go, the longer you have to wait. And this is 0.6 seconds, so you can wait as long as a second before you'll see the next action, because these are spontaneous events. Any of these are details which are going to be important if one really wants to understand what generates the patterns, which I'm going to show you, what sets the time scales and things like that.
Does it depend also on the duration of the duration of the HP? Depends on
yes,
the duration of
absolutely.
The
So here, each one we hold for maybe a half a second. So if you hold it for longer, then the longer.
Is that the integral of color?
It's what it has to do with this AHP current. So when you hold them, it's firing away, so calcium is building up in the cell. And so, which is turning on this AHP current. So then you have, the more calcium it builds up, the longer you have to wait until it decays, so it's able to fire again.
Why don't you say the adaptation? If you have accumulation of AHP current.
Oh.
But you don't say the adaptation spike frequency.
There's a little bit, which I'll show here. So another important property is the rebound. So here you'll see some adaptation, I think is what you need. So this is related to this T current, this low threshold calcium current. So this T current has the property that it deinactivates at very negative numbers. So you have to hyperpolarize the cell in order to get this current to start working. So this is why inhibition is going to be good to get the cells to fire. So, and these are the results of our model, but again, it matches pretty close to the experiments, is what we're going to do is keep the thing at rest so it fires at its 2 or 3 hertz. Then we hyperpolarize the cell for different amounts of time, and then, we then let go, and then you'll get these rebound bursts of action potentials. And then I guess there's some adaptation there in the fire.
Okay.
So the longer we hold it, the more the stronger the burst, and also the stronger the hyperpolarization, the stronger the burst of activity.
So here in the equations, you've reversed. You've just subtracted a current term from your equation.
Yeah.
So physiologically, is there some sense what that would mean to subtract current?
Well, these cells are going to be, remember, getting into the energy products. So there's a GTP. So this is going to send inhibition of the STM, which is going to send excitation back. And what I'm going to want to show you is that this network by itself, it's like a central energy generator, it's going to be able to generate these patterns of activity or oscillations. So, the basic idea is going to be that if this guy fires, it sends excitation here, and this guy fires. That's easy. But then the question is, if this guy fires, why should this guy fire again? It's getting inhibition. And the reason is because what I'm showing you here is because of this rebound, because when this sends inhibition, it deinactivates this T current, and that's going to allow the cells to fire basically due to rebound or whatever.
The FI curve, as we saw before, so there seems to be some acceleration.
Oh, yeah. So you know everything, don't you? Yeah, I should have said that here. So this curve, this curve.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this curve is actually, if you go to current frequency, should look something more like that. Okay, so what this does is, I believe, matches it very well at low inputs, which is going to be relevant for today's lecture. But to get, some, you can think about what would be the functional consequences of acceleration like this. And in order to get that, and also to get this thing to, so this is maybe to what, 300 hertz or something, some big number. In order to get this, we probably are going to have to add more funds to it. Okay? But this is not going to ever play a role in the sort of activity which I'm talking about today. Okay? But thanks for pointing out.
I was asking the question because there is some public taxing of the own STM, which is that if you depolarize too much, so then they're stopping to fire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think this is one of the explanations of the debolarization stimulation.
I don't think we need that for depolarization block. We can get that from very simple models, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a property of this STM.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And all right, so Wilson and Devin, that's let me say it my way and then see if you agree. So remember that one of the surgical procedures for Parkinson's is to stick an electrode here. It's to stimulate it. And they stimulate it 150 hertz or something like that. And so the classic idea, if you ask somebody who hasn't thought too much about it, they'll say it's depolarization block. See, remember another, so there's two things people can do is they can take a laser or a knife and they can cut this thing out. And that helps with Parkinson's. Or else they can stick electrodes, stimulate it, and that seems to help. So you might want to say that sticking an electrode in there is equivalent to surgically cutting out. You stop the activity. So there's this idea of depolarization block. And again, I don't know the right way to think about that. It's basically it stops the activity. But as David pointed out, is that these neurons love to fire at very high frequency. So this seems to imply that depolarization block is perhaps not the correct explanation. Okay. And in fact, there is evidence, maybe Bergman, I don't know, have they stimulated this and seen if the activity has stopped?
Was it, it's not Bergman, but it's a group
in France.
In France, there's a group in Bordeaux.
So to understand, you say the STM neurons like to fire at high frequency, usually?
They can maintain their firing at very high frequency. Yeah.
They can maintain.
Yeah.
But usually, I mean, the natural frequency is pretty low. This is what you showed there.
Well, maybe during movements, it's high. It's higher.
For short periods. I mean, they
for short periods. Periods. Oh, yeah. So, but a longer
period. You can deplete the resources if you continuously stimulate them.
Right. So there's maybe other mechanisms going on.
But, okay. But then the other point is the STN neurons in your model, they are capable of oscillating by themselves, right?
Yes.
But still, it's a, so you don't actually need the entire frequency for the oscillations. But
to get oscillations, no. But you know, so that, but what we're going to want to get is a tremor-like frequency and other sorts of patterns.
And for this, you need the.
We want to get synchrony. We're going to want to get raw, uncorrelated activity. You know, so how that has to be a network. Yeah, that was, thanks for pointing out. So again, this, I think that's a pretty good job of modeling it down here, but in order to get this one's gonna have to play. Yeah, I mean, there are different possibilities, maybe different sort of sodium currents or potassium currents. So that's, you know, the STM, GPD, I won't write down any equations. The GPD is actually way more troublesome. It's going to basically have very similar currents. But there have been a few papers, some older, Nambu, Linyas, Kita, Kite, which have both reported three types of cells in the GPD. Okay, and this seems to be pretty controversial. I mean, if you, when I read the papers, you know, you want to say these three types, this type in one paper corresponds to this type in this paper, and it's impossible to do that. They really have different properties and things. And in fact, some people report that maybe one of these types they see is not actually in the GPD, but maybe in some other structure. So what we did is we modeled what people believe, I think, is the most dominant neuron in the GPD. So this, well, resembles the high-frequency discharge with pause described by DeLong. These are the main properties in the GPD neurons. Let me just show you one figure. Again, these can fire really well at pretty high frequencies. If there's no applied current, they'll fire at well higher rate than the STN in our model. They're able to fire fairly fast, maintaining pretty much the same shape. If you hyperpolarize the neurons a little bit, they'll exhibit kind of a bursting activity. So there'll be a sequence of action potentials, then there'll be a pause, and then a sequence of action potentials. This is again due to the AHP current. So here calcium is building up, and that'll turn on the AHP, and then there'll be a delay before calcium could decay, and then it'll start up. There is this AHP. It's not as pronounced here in our model as in the STN, but again, it's not going to be as important, actually, in the activity patterns. So if you raise the current and then let go, there'll be kind of a delay before you see, before there's a return to us. Okay, so those are the model of the individual cells, which we tried to, you know, choose parameters and model as well as we could based on experiments. But then what we want to do is put this into a network.
So,
Okay, so now what we want to do is stick this into a network. And in the network, so we have the GPE and the STN cells. This is going to send inhibition to STN. This is going to send excitation back. There will be inhibition, inter-GPE inhibition in our model. And there will also be a parameter IAP in the GPE cells. This is supposed to somehow mimic the inhibition it's getting from the striatum. So the way we're going to play with the inhibition from the striatum is just to play with this parameter here. Okay. So I told you how we model the individual cells, but then we have to make choices about how we're going to model the network properties, like what is the footprint of connectivity, for example. And again, this is very poorly understood. I guess from what I understand, these are extremely difficult experiments to do. So what we, in our study, we played with different sorts of architecture. So we, as I'll show you, for example, well, here's a picture of three types of architecture that we played with. So basically three types of architecture. One is structure, tightly connected. So here we're going to assume that each GPE cell talks to a lot of STNs, and each STN talks to a lot of GPE. And it's pretty well homogeneous. We also studied what happens if you get structured sparsely connected, so each GPE talks to a few STNs, but in a structured sort of way. And then we took random sparsely connected connections. So the idea was to just to study what are the consequences of the different sort of activity patterns that can arise. How important is the anatomy in understanding the activity of the neurons? And, you know, what we found is that it's going to be quite important sometimes.
For each given architecture, you still have a lot of parameters.
Right. So, with
strength, so do you know something about this, right?
So with each architecture, then we're going to play with these different parameters to see how the activity pattern depend on those parameters. Okay, so that's what I want to show you now. I'm going to show you, well, I won't show you everything, of course, but we'll study different architectures, and within each architecture, various parameters.
But is it constraints of how this is really applied to experiment?
Again, I think this is very poorly understood. You certainly ask people who would know, right?
So, within the GPE, you had all-to-all inhibitory connections?
Sometimes. Not in every study. But for many of them, we had all-to-all. But we did play with that, too, whether it's local connections within GPE. There are a lot of games you can play. So here I said that this, you can have one guy talks to a lot of the STNs close by, or you can have an off-center kind of footprint. You know, and you can do the same thing within here. So we did a lot of studies with that, just to see the sort of activity patterns.
And within the STN, what kind of lateral connections do
you have? We don't have any, but there is evidence for excitatory.
So as a rule, the connection from the STM to the GP will be less diffuse than from the GP to the STM, as it is suggested by the...
No. There are papers that discuss that, but I don't think there's any depth.
No, I think that the, from STM to GPI, it's very diffuse.
That's diffuse, yeah, that's
from
the question.
STM to GP, now people say that it's also diffuse, I think. No, that's why I was asking that here. Yeah. So here you say that it's also parameters.
Right. There's, yeah, people like you talk about inhibitory surround or something.
Yeah, no, that's link as a link discovery.
Yeah.
But it's only inhibitory. Yeah.
What?
It's only inhibitory, so what's the meaning of inhibitory surround?
No. STM to GP is excitatory. From STM to GPI is excitatory. But the GPI is receiving inhibition from STM. So there's a diffuse excitation. And which
will continue because all these negatives. Because then you want to talk about the inhibition going to the balance. It's a very elegant theory.
Why in culture is it difficult to measure the connections? Not the connection strength, but the connection.
In culture, they probably refer.
You're really modeling culture here, right? You're really modeling this isolated, small.
And remember, in culture, you get the wrong answer. You get the slow frequency of 1 hertz. So maybe something I would like to suggest is that the culture does not have the right connectivity as you see in the animal. So
which are you modeling, the culture, or are you pretending to model in vivo, or what are you?
No, we'd like to talk about it. I suppose, but since this anatomical information is not there, well, we're going to, you know, just think about different sorts of architecture and see the consequences of that. So, so maybe in culture, as I said, the connectivity is kind of messed up. It's not what it should be, and because it's messed up, you don't see the tremor frequency, you see a much slower frequency.
Is it known in culture the connectivity is? And which of these different categories does the culture fit into?
It's probably more of too many connections, I would guess. But I'd have to check. I don't think that's specifically discussed in the Plans of Keto paper. But I would say there's too many connections. There's this issue of separation of information. Or maybe it's too random. All right. Maybe it's too random also. Okay, so just to show you the types of activity patterns that. So the first thing I'll do is show you just, we found basically 4 types of activity patterns. So I'll just show you the types of activity patterns, explain them a little bit, and then I'll show you how they depend on these various parameters. Okay. So these are really just the results of the computational studies. So one is...
another question.
Yeah.
Spatial dimensions, 2, 3, 1?
In these studies, we're just going to have basically 1, with about 10 to 20 neurons of each.
And culture is 2 or 3 or...
Oh, in culture? I'm not sure. Okay.
Only 2. Culture is usually unilayer, so it's 2 layers.
Yeah, so in these simulations I'm showing you, there's basically, it's just like what I've shown you here. So the spatial structure of them being along the line will play a role in some of these patterns, which I'm showing you.
And another question, these excitatory and inhibitory systems in general, in waves, which I know a lot about, dimensionality is crucial in terms of behavior. I don't know about in these excitatory and inhibitory systems, but I would guess dimensionality in terms of pattern would be quite important.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I think this is one thing we're trying to do, but haven't made too much progress. How much does it depend on dimensionality? What other patterns can you see in if you have 2 or higher dimensional So I will show you some waves which we like, but then the question is what's going to happen to these waves as we go to higher units? So you know, I completely agree with people, we just haven't made it that far yet. I think patterns like this will go up to higher, it doesn't depend too much on the dimension. But when we get these wave-like activities, then, you know.
When you say, just for clarity, when you say spatial dimensions, it means the connectivity, like if you say one dimension, then it's only neighbor connections? Or what's the meaning? What's the difference between one and two dimensions?
So I guess so you could then you can talk about this cell talks to, let's say, five neurons, STN neurons, which are somehow closely related to this one. Okay? And what we want to talk, I will show you waves which will be propagating through the network. And so that's going to depend on the fact that there's this one-dimensional structure here. But if there was 2D, then it's going to spread its activity more to a ball. In 2D, it's not clear how that's going to affect it.
So 2D would mean that within each nucleus, each neuron could connect to each other.
It means a lattice of neurons.
Sorry?
Imagine in the plane, a lattice of neurons versus...
Yeah, I can imagine below the plane, but here it means that it's just the connectivity. It doesn't matter how you plug them, right? It's just how they connect to each other.
If you have, for instance, a wave of activity arising in each other wave, then it may depend very much on
the one-dimensional structure. I'm asking what's the difference between one-dimensional structure and two-dimensional structure in your scheme here. One-dimensional means that each one connects only to its neighbor?
No. So there's probably not much difference between the structure per se, but the sort of activity, when you talk about structure, so in one dimension or two dimension, you can talk about the possibility of what I would say different footprints. So one cell could talk to either STN neurons close by, whether it be in one dimension or two dimension, or else you can talk to all the other STNs, and that doesn't depend on dimension. But the consequence of that, of what sort of activity patterns you see, probably, especially in the case of waves, depends on the dimensionality.
So you could reduce two dimension to one dimension if you just unwrapped it, but then nearest neighbors, your five nearest neighbors, you would have, you know, two to your left, and then you would have two bond connections. I mean, any, you know, you can also read your two-dimensional network in lexicographical order, but then if you try to think what nearest neighbors connection means in 2D, it would be like that. So in some sense, what he's saying is that, whether it's 1D or 2D, it's confounded with what the connections are. Yeah. You could make a 2D thing look 1D if you included these big, long connections.
The point is, to call it 1D, you find in the structure, you find translation of symmetry. It's really translation in this one dimension. If you have a two-dimensional structure,
I'm not talking about the outcomes of it. I'm talking about the essence. What is the difference? Outcome.
I talk about the structure. Okay. Now, if all connect to all, then dimension is not meaningful. When you are in
all connect to all with equal strings.
Then you call it what?
Or
if it's wrong, dimension one means only nearest neighbors. Can you put the other simply and show what's the
difference?
This is one D. How you're putting in the area. So this is the connection.
Right. But the connection, even if it's not called nearest neighbor, even if it's next to nearest neighbor, then next to nearest neighbor, but you stop here, then it has still this one-dimensional translational symmetry.
So in one dimension, you can see a wave go like this. But the question is, well, in 2D, is the wave going to propagate
over
this?
What's the difference in connectivity? I'm sorry that I bothered you. But in connectivity between one and two dimensions?
They could be exactly the same, in some sense.
When you say it's the same,
you can put things in B and yet have the symmetry only in this way. In which case, it's a one-dimensional structure. But if the symmetry is such that you can...
In connection.
In connection. But if the symmetry is such...
Okay. Words of connectivity was only in one dimension.
So in 1D, you can say that this guy talks to three STNs. It's the one nearest it, if that makes sense, and it's 2 meters.
here you can talk about the same thing, this guy talks to jet, and it's a new movement, so that would be along the lattice, all these guys. So in some sense, you can define these the same way, I suppose, I'm not that confused. But then, all right, but under certain parameter ranges, the consequences of this is that you'll get a wave of activity that'll spread, because this guy fires and it'll spread its activity, and it'll just propagate. But the question is, do you get the same thing in 2D? Will you see kind of a circular thing spreading or not? And my guess is no, this is something more complicated, and that complexity depends on the image. So that's the way Anyway, I just wanted to just define and show you the different sort of patterns that you can get in such a network. So this is what I would call clustering. Clustering means that the entire population, this will not depend on dimension, that the population breaks up into different groups. For example, two subpopulations of cells. The activity of neurons within each group is synchronized with each other, but the different groups are out of phase with each other. So for example, here if there are 10 STN cells, and this is time, and the color somehow represents the activity, so you'll see that every other STN cell behaves pretty much exactly the same, they're synchronized, but they're out of phase with the other group of STNs. So this is, does that make sense? So this is one type of activity pattern. It's not hard to get this to go at pretty much the tremor range. Okay, this is quite robust to parameters. Now we'll discuss in a minute what sort of architecture and parameter range you need to get such an activity pattern.
Are they actually spiking? I mean, the voltages seem to be pretty low.
Maybe I can show you a picture. Well, yeah, they're spiking. Okay, within each. So this is spiking within here, and then it's quiet, and then it's spiking, and then it's quiet. Okay, so each individual cell will have action potential, and it's quiet, and it does this.
But at the end of the spiking, it bursts.
Oh yeah, then there's a burst at the very end. Actually, this is a rebound burst. Okay, this is about 50 hertz, 25 to 50, I forget, within each one of these bursts. Okay, and the whole thing is going at about the tremor. Another sort of activity pattern is, and this I think is closer related to the plants in Quito, is the entire population kind of bursts or spikes with loose synchrony among cells for a certain amount of time, maybe half a second or whatever, then there's a long quiet period, and then you'll have this loose synchrony among cells. So this is what we would call episodic behavior. So this is going at about 1 hertz. So I think this is more closely actually related to the Plunzett Quito sort of result. So the first one was clustering. This I would call more episodic activity. The third. I'm showing you STNs. GPE is similar, not exactly the same. In general, it'll be a little bit less.
Well, what's responsible for the time scale of 1 second here?
Well, I was going to go through that later, but I mean, basically the idea is this is the AHP within the STM. So what is going on, and I'll just say this now, and we can talk about it, because I'll be here long enough if you really find out. So within here, so if one STN cell fires, then you spread the activity. This is, think of kind of a random architecture. So if one cell fires, it's going to cause the GP cells to fire. That's going to cause other STN cells to fire. It's going to go back and forth, and eventually the activity will spread through the population. Okay? So it spreads through the population, and because I have somewhat of a random architectures, you know, you don't expect any spatial structure to it. So then these guys are going to be firing away. So what's going to turn off the activity? So what turns off the activity here is the AHP and the GPE cell. So calcium builds up here, eventually builds up enough. This is not going to be able to respond to STM, so that stops the activity. Then what causes this long delay? Well, remember, there's the AHP and STM. If this guy fires for a while, calcium builds up here, it stops, and then if you turn it off, you have to wait a while for calcium to decay here. Up to, remember I showed you up to a second, it might be up to a second delay, before this will spontaneously fire again. So then when it spontaneously fires, it starts the whole thing over again.
And we see here only the GTE, the GPEs, or we see both GP and STM?
This is just the STM.
Just the STM.
I do have some pictures later on, I forgot what I brought out, both of them. Okay?
Then with the others, final kind of the starting point or ending point of this range, if I look at the other group of neurons.
Oh no, this is every neuron in the network.
Every neuron.
This shows every STM. Every STM.
Okay.
Okay? So this doesn't break up into these two groups.
Right? Okay. It looks like that, perhaps rather randomly, that it looks like four or five of the neurons fire simultaneously.
Yeah, you could have a certain degree of, there could be correlations.
No, I mean it when it comes out of the rest time.
Oh.
So if you look at how it emerges from the rest time, right. There's a whole bunch of them that start firing, not one that fires and spreads. They all don't fire, but...
Usually it's one, you know.
Usually it's one, is that
yeah.
Is the homogeneous population, or they all have the same parameters?
And what I'm showing you, it's homogeneous.
So they're all identical.
These are identical.
And this was,
but we did play with that a little bit. They are somewhat robust.
Okay. And which
coupling
architecture was
this? This is the sparsely connected random. Okay.
So each neuron talks to how many typically on average?
Two or three. Okay. So it's not homogeneous in the connectivity.
No, it is the.
But they are identical cells.
Neural properties, so they're all identical. You say it's robust.
It is robust. You know, it's more robust to some parameters than others, but that I'm pretty comfortable. Okay, so two more activity patterns. One is uncorrelated activity, so you get patterns like this. And maybe I'll wait to tell you when you see something like this. I discussed this a little bit in detail. So this we'd like to think of more as the normal state. We have uncorrelated activity between the neurons.
What? Uncorrelated in which sense?
Well, we did correlation, some correlation studies, which I can show you.
Okay. Is it 10 hertz firing days or something like that?
Probably a little bit faster. Can be up to like 25 or something like that. In this particular picture, I'm not sure. Usually around 25. And so then the last sort of patterns that you can see up here, I have periodic boundary conditions, by the way, which is why this thing keeps dropping. But this, they have this, it gives this system, this is, I don't know if people are familiar with filament networks, but there's many, and we can discuss the differences between the two. They have a lot of similar properties. And this is in the John Renzel and other people who studied filament networks talk about lurching waves. So this is an example of a lurching wave. So the idea is that if one guy fires, it'll spread its activity to neighbors, and they'll fire. Well, they'll inhibit these guys. So then these guys have to wait a little bit, then they'll fire. Then they'll spread their activity, and then this will spread, but it'll kind of lurch along because these guys fire due to rebound. And this is a nice example of that. And these are very robust two parameters. Okay, so under what conditions do you see these various parameters? So just to show you, kind of moving on. So
what time is the
Here, there's no termination of episode. The thing will just go.
No, I mean, if you. It's not a pond.
It's a periodic boundary.
If this was long enough, you would get a pulse that moves, and then it might generate someplace else and get another one spontaneously. So if you start this, if you just look here, you'll get a pulse. So if there's more build of calcium maybe behind the front, so you have to have asymmetry in the initial conditions, I suppose, to get it to move one way or else it'll move in both directions. Okay? And actually, one reason it's so robust is what we played with is the cross-GPE inhibition actually helps in maintaining these waves. So this depends on quite a structured architecture, and this inhibition here really helps in the generation of systems. So just a couple pictures to show you how these depend on parameters. So this is the unstructured architecture. This is sparse random. Okay? What we did was we plotted one parameter. This is the G S to G, so that's the maximal conductance from STN to GPE versus inter-GPE inhibition. So that's two parameters you play with. You can choose other ones. And we plotted here, you see that if you increase this, you get continuous spiking, which would be uncorrelated activity. Up here you also see uncorrelated activity, but it's more sparse, it's much slower, and then you get this episodic spiking in between. Okay. So to go, for example, from here to something like that, you can increase the excitation from the STN to GPE. You could also, by the way, go from here to here by decreasing, this is almost equivalent, the inhibition from the striatum. And so this is, or is it increasing? It's the way that dopamine is supposed to be. Okay. Just a couple more pictures. So here you have more of a structured. This is patterns you see when you have structured, lot of connectivity. One thing I'll just point out, which I kind of like, just from the point of view of pattern formation, you get these episodic waves. So you can get these waves which are generated, there's a long silent period, and then they start up again. So it's kind of a nice pattern. Again, if you change parameters, it's easy to go from the sort of structured sort of activity to more of a, well, this looks pretty correlated, because we get continuous sort of activity.
When is it? Turn off in the activity. Where's the information stored about the direction of the wave? Is that in the other layer?
The turn off is going to be in almost always in the buildup of calcium and GPE. That, by the way, depends on the strength of inhibition here or the strength of excitation where the turn off going to be. But if it turns off, it's going to be because calcium can build up enough here to turn on this potassium current. So the cells cannot respond to STN, so you get this turn off. So the turn off is in the AHP here, and then the delay is always because of the AHP down in STN. Okay.
Yeah, but then the information about, say, the direction the wave is propagating must have been stored somewhere else.
So why did it? Why
that's
did
true.
It
why does it go? That's fairly a mystery. What exactly chooses the direction? It usually chooses one direction, and that's due to almost always some sort of asymmetry in the initial conditions.
As opposed in the initial conditions, but not in the network.
Not in the network.
Which is
so we have asymmetry. Not in the network. No.
Yeah.
It can go both ways.
Right, because this inhibition here, if one guy fires, it's going to spread its activity. So both of these may want to fire. The one may want to fire first, a little bit ahead of itself. If it'll fire a little bit, it'll send inhibition, and it'll prevent this guy from firing, and then it'll take off in this direction. Okay?
Is there some noise? I mean, what, why should it fire earlier? Is there some noise that you put in there?
We have put noise. It actually makes the system better. And in this simulation, we don't have noise. You see, well, you know, you'll always have, it will not be completely synchronized.
Computation sequence, or?
And also, what?
What makes the difference? The computation sequence? What, if there's no noise and everything's symmetric, what?
Well, we don't start.
Initial data isn't symmetric.
Initial data is not symmetric.
Okay. This is really, I mean, isn't there some degree of randomness in the architecture here?
Not in this simulation. One could have randomness, and again, sometimes randomness actually helps the simulation, and this is a case where it will pick it up. Okay. But a little bit of, if you have initial conditions and not identical, just a little bit, you're very robustly generating these waves. Okay, and this in fact shows that the initial conditions, when you start off, have to be very close to each other. If they're a little bit different, that's enough to get it to move in one direction.
Which architecture is this again?
This is the tightly connected structured architecture.
So no randomness in the definition of the connection.
Correct. And it's periodic, so, you know, these guys actually talk to people back over here. So in a way, it's kind of interesting that you can get this uncorrelated, even though this doesn't look too uncorrelated, but you can get robustly, rather uncorrelated looking continuous activity in a very structured architecture, okay, if you choose parameters to look, which is something I'd like to understand a bit better.
So this we discovered almost.
What?
This will correspond to one monster.
Yeah. Where are you? Okay. It's not one monster.
Well, it's not for highly correlated. Not really.
Well, in this picture it is, but like I say, it's not too hard to get things that look more uncorrelated. And we did do, I can show you, you know, correlation studies just to convince ourselves that it was quite uncorrelated. I don't know. So here is just some pictures, showing that we did do these systematic studies of varying parameters and seeing when you get various types of activity patterns in these different parameters. So maybe this is a good, So for example, in the sparse structure, it really loves to do these clustered activities. So you get I should say a few things. So for example, you get the clustering like I talked about. You get episodic clustering, so it'll do this clustering, there'll be a long delay, quiet period, it'll start clustering again. Weak clustering, so what do I mean by that? Weak clustering, or some people would call dynamic clustering. So, you know, these solutions I'm showing you are not globally stable, they're quite robust, but there are other patterns one can find. For example, in the sort of clustering I told you about, every cell belongs to one population, okay? But there are not too hard to generate solutions where the membership can change dynamically. So one cell could belong to one of the clusters for a while, and then all of a sudden it'll switch its membership to another one.
Can you have also three cycles?
Absolutely. You have three, you can have four, so you can play up games right now. Four is pretty much the limit that you can get really nice clusters. After that, it really gets kind of dynamic. And so the reason I mention this is because these have been reported in the literature by a number of groups. So people who have measured activity in GPI, for example, have seen a sort of clustering, but it's more of a dynamic cluster.
But the story of increasing the inhibitory-to-inhibitory coupling inside this gene, whatever it was, is how you place the network in a normal or an asynchronous state.
Yes. And also, so there's the two parameters. There's the inter-GPE, so increasing inhibition here, and there's also the inhibition from the striatum. Playing with that can improve even more to the normal. And
that's not in your model, or it is as an
external? It is a parameter in the model. I'm not showing you studies where we played with this parameter.
So that's an external drive.
External drive, yeah.
This is also inhibitory.
This is inhibitory, yes.
So the transition from normal to Parkinson's.
Yeah.
So it would be, it's by changing the input from skeleton to GP.
So the two parameters would be this one and this one.
Also, you have also an effect, you assume that there is an effect of dopamine reflection on the...
And there is experimental evidence of that. Okay, I'll just say that.
Okay.
I can point you. And our results are consistent with what this. So maybe it's a good time to just sum up with a little bit of a discussion. So here's what I have for a discussion. The STM-GP neuron exhibits several types of firing patterns, waves, clustering, irregular, spiking. It may be episodic or continuous. Of course, the patterns depend on various parameters. So this is what the questions were just about. How do you go from clustering of waves, which we'd like to think of the Parkinsonian, to irregular behavior, which we'd like to think of the normal? Well, you can increase intrapalatal inhibition. So this is inhibition among GP cells. Or you can get less hyperpolarizing input from the striatum. And there is evidence that dopamine perhaps acts this way.
Okay. So too much dopamine is what leads to the part.
No, it's loss of it.
Loss of it.
I'm sorry, and that corresponded to what your diagram. So if we assume tightly coupled architecture.
So remember the, I should have just kept this picture on. We had this diagram. Yeah, GPB, STM, GPR. So this is excitatory, inhibitory. Yeah, this is where dopamine is. So that acts on the striatum. So presumably that's going to affect the amount of inhibition we get here. So this is the parameter that we're going to play with.
The input curve.
Could you put up the summary slide again or the?
I'm actually going to review that again, that statement. Should we go to that? About the effect of dopamine. Okay. In fact, so maybe why don't I do that now? So it's good to remind ourselves the classic theory and then maybe a little bit of what we want to say. So this is the standard theory of the role of the indirect pathway. How do you go from normal to Parkinsonian? So this is the normal, and this is the Parkinsonian. So the story is that the effect of losing dopamine here will be to increase the inhibition.
Increase
what?
Increase what?
The amount of inhibition from the striatum to GP.
That makes
it
abnormal.
That's how you go from normal to abnormal.
Could you put up your phase diagrams again? Because I've memorized them backwards. You had those hand-sketched phase diagrams.
Those were for tuning the connection strings between GPD and STM. They were for a fixed.
Yeah, I did not change this parameter. I actually changed this parameter. So sending more excitation here is kind of like sending less inhibition here.
But you did change the GPD in the inhibitory, not coming from the striatum, but the...
Right. So maybe I should show you the next transparent, and then we can talk about this a little bit slower. So remember, the problem with this is that this is not going to account for the tremor or the synchrony. So what we would like to say is that when you go from the normal to the Parkinsonian, not only do you increase the inhibition here, but you decrease the intra-GPE inhibition. Both of these have the effect of increasing the interactions between the STM-GPE, and these interactions can, first of all, increase the output and give rise to these various patterns. So maybe this summarizes our results the best.
Could this be tested in the culture, like when you can you block the culture specifically with GABA and GPE, the GBE part, and then see if the...
I'd like to think so. We're talking to people, so I'll find out.
So basically, you're saying that if there's an increase in admission from the striatum to the GPE, if this were accompanied by a weakening of connections within the GPE, there's no experimental evidence of, yeah?
No, there is experimental evidence that dopamine perhaps does decrease this inhibition.
Okay, so if you had those...
There is some evidence by Kimpa.
Okay, so those are the two key things to get the oscillations, correct?
Yes, each one individually will do something, but it's, this is much more robust to do it, both in the combination of the two.
So does your model explain why stimulating the STM blocks those selections?
Yeah, I've been playing with that. I mean, one could certainly get that. You have to really stimulate a lot. But what that has to do with deep brain stimulation, this really seems like an area that people, it's hard to get a definite answer out of people if that's actually what happens. So yeah, this is something we're definitely thinking about and we're playing with a lot, is stimulating SDN and see possible reasons why this would desynchronize the system or prevent the STM. It's not too hard to do stuff like that. But
do you have any clue why? Would you have any clue for the reason why it does not select us? What takes it out of the activation?
Mathematically, I don't know, what's the biological equivalent for depolarization block? It's if you have this, so I like to think in terms of the phase plan. So you could get oscillations. So this is a standard relaxation oscillator. This is the voltage, and this is one of the channels to get these oscillations. I'm not sure if this makes any sense. So then when you stimulate it very fast, it's like getting a constant excitatory input, you kind of lower this qubit here, and then you get just a fixed point on in the excited state, and that corresponds to depolarization. So actually, this, one can do this computation. But it's hard, yeah, whether or not that's really what happens is one of the stories.
So would they, when you said you're observing Parkinsonian state, did that correspond to seeing traveling waves, or did that correspond to seeing synchronized spiking or clustering?
People haven't seen waves, but I don't think they've looked for waves, so that's what it would be nice to think. They've seen waves more than philanthropy, so I think there's a possibility they exist here. So I think clustering, there's evidence for the clustering, that you don't have global, so people who see synchrony, and again, that's the point they go to take this, that it's not global synchrony that one sees, that there's a dispersion in the phase of some kind, which suggests perhaps there's a cluster.
So in the model, with the computation, if you saw the clustering behavior with 1 to 2 hertz frequency, then that's what you would label as Parkinsonian?
No, it's the clustering at the tremor frequency that I would label as clustering. That's Parkinson tremor.
So you have a little bit of color for this.
That I would like to label as, okay, so this pattern, okay, so there's the two issues. So one issue is, so this is what I would like to fantasize and guess is corresponding to tremor. Okay, so this is clustering, it's going at the right frequency. It's two populations, so it's maybe moving the muscles, whatever. So this is what I would like to say corresponds to the tremor.
And that frequency is 2 hertz?
No, this is the, should be the correct frequency. This is 2 seconds. So this is 1 second, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I mean, okay, so this is at the correct frequency.
And is this in phase, out of phase, consistent with the recordings? People recorded.
Yes, there is some evidence for that, that you don't have this global synchrony that perhaps...
How do they have anti-phase correlation? Do they ever see anti-phase?
There are some problems with data you see clearly in some two type of issues. So these are in-phase horizontal. Is this thing not changing in amount of time?
One of the papers that you talked about.
So actually there is one paper which was published in last January, which is a more interesting presentation.
Of the my one?
Of Raz.
Raz, yeah, the paper of Raz.
And the second, actually there are two papers. One of them is the other one, the Journal of Core Science.
Yeah.
Was a study of the patient.
In a GPA?
GPI, both of cells, and also the process theater, some data. But I think that the receptor, I think it was, I don't remember the some data. So for instance, a good question would be to do cross correlation between receptor and nucleus and GPE.
Right. Experimentally.
Yeah. But this is data.
There's a lot of, one can imagine a lot of studies like that.
But you say that the experimentally observed oscillations are of much lower frequency.
No, that's in the culture.
In the culture.
So I would argue that the, so they have
so these are recordings during tremor action in the...
No. Those are... Okay.
Yes, these are, the last experiment is during tremor.
Is
MPTP.
The culture is just growing them.
So this is the cultural oscillation.
So this is at the lower frequency, and the difference here is perhaps that the architecture is different, and you have to respect the architecture in order to...
Would you remind us of the two architectures again?
This is more random.
And sparse.
And this is sparse, yeah.
And the other one was quite tight and regular.
No, the other one, for this one, was sparse and regular.
Sparse.
This is sparse.
I had another question. I mean, every other, this is more like a binary oscillation. Every other neuron is oscillating out of phase with its neighbor. And this,
right, that's because we just took the spectral off.
It's one neuron, every color, every, it's one one?
Yeah.
We just took the nearest neighbor for this, for that simulation. Okay, so this guy inhibits these, guys oscillate, and while they oscillate, it sends inhibition to the neighbors, keeping them from oscillating. And then something happens, the T current deactivates, so these guys are able to fire, and that prevents this guy from firing. So that's, yeah.
But I wonder if in biological application, is it every other neuron, or is it clusters of neurons that you really...
This could be a connectivity architecture.
Yeah, you could certainly get, many other different sort of patterns, and depends on the... So for example, one thing we play with is not to have one guy talk to people close by, but more of an off-center couple, since couple estimates further away. And there you get some very interesting sort of patterns. You can get clustering, you can get these dynamic clustering, whatever.
Let me ask you a hard question. What do you take as the key element of the model, and do you have a critical prediction that could test it? Because there are so many parameters always in models, and so much ways to play with it and to match the data or not, but is there any key point here that could be tested?
Yeah, I don't know. Is it possible to play with these, take your favorite parameter when these conductances or input, and see if you get transitions or patterns from the structure P1, from clustering to A sequence. So for example, in one of these diagrams here, this seems to have a lot of predictions in it. You know, is it possible to see waves, first of all? And as you, is it possible to increase this parameter and go from the waves to the sort of activity?
I think there's one question, which is related to what I was saying. If you take the system, what you would like to be the normal state, so it means that you have some connection, lateral connection, the GPI and the GPE, which are fixed. And then when you have movement, so the movement will be like changing the input from striatum to GPE.
Or perhaps it's the input to the STM from the cortex.
Or input to the STM for the cortex. So the first probably is the one which are applied to the STM.
Right.
So then the question is what happens to the network? Are you changing to another pattern? Well, you do not want that. You want to remain asynchronous. You want to change the finite, presumably.
You mean during the Parkinson's?
No, during normal state, when there is movement. So, I mean, this can be a prediction of the model, that you what will happen when you're in movement.
Right.
But would it be a critical, I mean, this is a tough question, I mean, regarding modeling, is would it be a critical specific prediction for this model, or because you have so many, I mean, you have now, you move the, say, the problem from the in vivo case to the model, but still you have many, many parameters that even you are not sure what everyone is doing. Then the question is just in the outset, if you want to understand something more, do we have, what is the key principle that the model suggests, and is it testable to see whether the system works like this?
Faith diagram is a key result.
Sorry?
I don't understand. It's a very detailed result about what should happen when you change each parameter of the model.
You can play with the parameters. You can match your data. You can play with the parameters to make sure.
But this probably exists.
Yeah, but this could be tested if the GPU and STN go into oscillation of the time to.
Yeah, for instance.
So, would you take this as the key, say the key element of the model?
You know, listen, from my point of subject, it's so.
Sorry?
Controversial. So little is known, but so much is known. It really seems like an area where modeling can really help test all these many, many ideas that are being thrown out. So this sort of study.
So what would be an example of one good test that could tell us one thing from another? What would be a good?
If you stimulate this,
okay,
what would be the effect on here?
So what's the prediction of what you stimulate?
I was changing the subject, and something I would like to do is understand this deep stimulation. Okay? But I think these phase diagrams make many predictions that could be tested. It's not known what the architecture is, for example. That may play a key role in sort of happens. So if you change these parameters and achieve certain changes in activity patterns, that may be a window into understanding the sort of architecture. And then the better you understand that may be better to understand the dynamics of the system and how these various abnormal activity patterns arise.
You mean what you'd like to know is what the phase diagram of the real system is?
Yes. So this is making predictions based on the knowledge that we have now of what that phase diagram is. And most obviously,
To say this, you have to be sure that at least within the model for a given architecture, you have this particular phase diagram. So it won't change, let's say, if you change some neural parameters, which are some of them you are guessing. Right? So the question is, can you really claim that if you take this particular architecture, that will be the relevant phase diagram? Can it change also if within the model you play with some of the parameters which you get? Because if you can get another phase diagram out of the same architecture, this would not be a prediction. How sure you are that the phase diagram which you get?
We're pretty sure. I mean, it's quite robust. This shows that these patterns are quite robust. And obviously, they're not globally stable, but they're quite robust to these changes in parameters. So, in the phase diagram, it shows that you do get this episodic clustering in a wide range of parameter values here. Okay.
Yeah, but the order, let's say, can the order of these different solutions change if you do something in the model? I'm not asking, of course, about specific values of parameters, but the shape of the diagram, how must it be?
The shapes of these curves?
Yeah. Just the order. Let's see, some kind of all features of this.
It is quite robust. It's quite robust. I mean, you know, if you change the dynamics of the T current enough, then obviously things are going to change. So it's within a range of the intrinsic parameters of the cell, and you get a diagram.
In culture, how much can you change these two parameters by doing things to the culture?
I'm not sure.
You started off this, I think, by saying that one of the things you were hoping to explain that was lacking the standard model was an explanation of rest and travel. That was kind of how you introduced a lot of the oscillations in this area. I don't know the experimental evidence, but is there evidence for oscillations during resting tremor? Is that well known? And do the oscillations go away with initiation of movement, which is what the Parkinsonian patients have, or do they continue?
I guess there's these questions. There's evidence of the oscillate. When you bring oscillations and synchronies, there's some question about the frequencies. That some cells are twice the tremor, there's some that have the tremor. There's surely evidence of these increased oscillation synchrony during the tremor.
The frequency of the tremor is not the same as the frequency of the oscillations, which is observed. And the other question is, what happens when there is an oscillation of the tremor? The experiment is in PTP monkeys. So the monkey is so akinetic that it cannot do any movement.
So you could create a little bit.
What is known is that in monkeys which are not tremors, so the oscillations are less pronounced in GPI.
So it's a very weak correlation, though. You don't have a tremor to activities correlation.
Now there is another question of tremor to activity correlation, which is if you have some coherence between the limbs and your tremor. And I think that the evidence, I would say that if there is coherence, it's rather weak. So probably there are several, I mean, if you buy the hypothesis of central oscillator, so there are several central oscillators which correspond to different regions in the So there is, I mean, the question is relating the oscillations to the tremor is really still not an issue.
But it would seem that one prediction here is that this is kind of the source, the ultimate source of these resting oscillations, resting tremors. And if that was true, then you could interfere with in an in vivo prep, interfere with these and show that you can
That's what this DBS does somehow. If it's blocking this mechanism, it's not clear. It is doing something to these cells that is blocking the tremors.
What did you say that was? Oh, the STN
stimulation. The high
STN stimulation.
Thank you.